Welcome to this week's message from A New Church. For more information, or if you'd like to contact us, please visit our website, newchurch.nz. Thanks for tuning in, and we hope you enjoy this message.
And then the Lord spoke to Jonah a second time. Get up and go to the great city of Nineveh and deliver the message I have given you. The Lord spoke to Jonah a second time. God is the God of second chances. Don't you love that about God? And the third chance, and the fourth chance, and the fifth chance. If I was God, I would have thought, Jonah, you've just stuffed this whole thing up. And although I would have forgiven Jonah, I don't know if I would have had much faith and trust in Jonah and what he was doing in his office as a prophet. Well, yeah, I've forgiven you, but no, you blew it, Jonah. And maybe you can, like, I don't know, sit up on the beach and do some stuff there, but I'm going to give this call to someone else because he just wrecked it. We don't see that about the heart of God. Then Jonah spoke to Jonah a second time. He gave Jonah the same message. God is a God of second chances. And I'm so glad he is. I don't know about you, but I've stuffed up a few times. Have you? I said, I've stuffed up a few times. Everyone's like. Nice. Again, you might have gone through some stuff. It might have been all your fault. You might have wrecked it. God is the God of second chances. That's the heart of God. I love God. Verse 3, this time Jonah obeyed the Lord's command and went to Nineveh. He didn't want to be swallowed by anything again. A city so large it took 3 days to see it all. On that day, Jonah entered the city. He shouted to the crowds, 40 days from now, Nineveh will be destroyed. And I love this about Jonah. He had surrendered his life, and straight after he surrendered his life, God gave him something to do. It was like, surrender now turns and morphs into service, which is the natural progression of our journey with God. Surrender is just the very beginning, and then God's got stuff for us to do because he cares about the world. So surrender and service go hand in hand. When I was a young fella, I thought surrender was like the end of the journey, you know, and I'd often go up to just get prayer and get my life right with God. I thought, oh, phew, I'm going to heaven again. Lord, take me now. I'm right with you, you know. Didn't blow it again, whatever. And it's like, that's good, but that's the very beginning. It's not the end of our journey. We surrender our lives to God. Then he gives us a call. He gives us something to do. It's called service in the kingdom of God, which is a little bit out of kilter when someone surrenders and they never mature onto service. They surrender their lives, which is great, but in my opinion, if we just stay at the surrender part and never actually move into helping others and serving in the plans and purposes of God, there's something a little bit wrong there because surrender will always eventually transform into service in our lives if we're being obedient. And this is what we see with Jonah. He surrenders and then he actually goes and does something about it. And he goes to the city and does what God asked him to do. So conviction, responsibility, acknowledgement in chapter 1, 2, then surrender, then into service. Surrender will always move us to service. In verse 5, the people of Nineveh believed God's message. And from the greatest to the least, they declared a fast and put on burlap to show their sorrow. These guys were a complete pagan nation. They didn't really have a clue about anything to do with God other than he was powerful and he was going to destroy them. And they come to their senses and they make a decision. They now are surrendering their lives to God and they do what they think is right. Well, we've got to actually show God that we mean what we say. So an outward, they did this thing to actually show what was the state of their heart, which is good. And I don't know if it just took one man to completely turn a city. I think God was working on the Ninevites' heart for a long time before this, but Jonah and his obedience, that was the catalyst. God will always be working behind the scenes. He's just waiting for you and me to say yes to him so that we can be like the missing part in the puzzle to see his plans and purposes fulfilled, because he always works through people. He co-partners with us. It's because he loves relationship with us. So God was, in my opinion, again, working behind the scenes, but it took Jonah to be the catalyst to see God's plans and purposes fulfilled in that city. It took one man to see a whole city turn to God. We're not talking about like a family or a couple of people, and that's always awesome, but one whole city, a large city, the population of Tauranga, turning to God because of one person's obedience, wasn't really about Jonah at all. It was because God partners with people, but he loves people. And it wasn't about Jonah's comfort. It was about a nation's salvation. D.L. Moody, which he was in the 1800s, just an incredibly powerful and an amazing minister of God. It says this about him. When D.L. Moody was just starting in the ministry, he heard a preacher say, "The world has yet to see what God can do with a man fully surrendered to him." Moody that night said, "By God's grace, I will be that man." It is said that Moody shook two continents for God, and over a million souls came to Christ under his preaching and ministry. However, Moody had very little formal education, and he was not a polished speaker, but God greatly used his life. And God can greatly use my life, and God can greatly use your life. It's not about how spectacular we are. Actually, more than not, God chooses to use broken people that have got a few issues. And as we see in the story as we go along, Jonah was far from perfect. He was, he had stopped being outwardly rebellious, but he still had quite a rebellious heart. But God still delighted in using him. A lot of us, if you're anything like me, think, well, God would be able to use someone else because I've got a whole lot of struggles and issues in my life. And you think, well, I think, well, that's excused me. That's disqualified me. Someone else can do it, so I'm not held responsible. Actually, it probably holds you, makes you more qualified if you've got a few issues. Because God chooses the broken things of the world and the despised things to show his glory through. And then we realize it's not about us. It's about God working through us. And we live in a constant state of humility and awe. We don't depend on our own giftings at all, but we depend upon him. And a life, each day is a life of adventure and breakthrough and excitement. Verse 6, when the king of Nineveh heard what Jonah was saying, so obviously someone grabbed Jonah, brought him into the courts. This is the king of Nineveh. He stepped down from his throne and took off his royal robes and dressed himself in burlap and sat on a heap of ashes. Pretty sure the ashes would have been cold. Then the king and his nobles sent this decree throughout the city: no one, not even the animals from your herds and flocks, may eat or drink anything at all. Poor animals. People and animals alike must wear garments of mourning, and everyone must pray earnestly to God. They must turn from their evil ways and stop their violence. Nineveh was known as the city of bloodshed. And there would have been a lot of ignorant people in the city, but the motivation and the violence would have come from the top. So probably this king was extremely, extremely wicked, yet he humbles himself. They must turn from their evil ways and stop all their violence. Who can tell? Perhaps even yet God will change his mind and hold back his fierce anger from destroying us. In verse 6 it says, when the king of Nineveh heard. Now the world is watching me, and the world is watching you, and listening and observing. You know, not many of us stand on a platform and preach like I'm doing this morning, but all of us preach with our lives. Every single day with our families and with our workplaces and in our schools. What are people hearing? So when the king of Nineveh heard, and he humbled himself, this wicked, wicked man who had probably been responsible for a lot of death and a lot of murder, humbles himself. God is the God of the impossible. I recently read about the story of Manasseh. Now, Manasseh was one of the most evil kings in Judah, and Hezekiah, which was one of the most godly kings, was his father. A lot of these guys needed to go to parenting seminars, I think, back in the Old Testament, because it just seems like there's no continuation a lot of the time. A godly man and then like a real ungodly son. So Manasseh was incredibly evil, probably one of the most evil kings in Judah and in Israel. He threw his two sons, sacrificed them to his God, burnt them alive. So that sort of shows how evil he was. But in 2 Chronicles 33, it says something interesting. But while in deep distress, Manasseh sought the Lord, his God, and sincerely humbled himself before the God of his ancestors. And when he prayed, the Lord listened to him and was moved by his request. So the Lord brought Manasseh back to Jerusalem and to his kingdom. Then Manasseh finally realized that the Lord alone is God. Then he starts to bring reform to the whole nation of Judah. He was a man who was extremely evil, and he turns back and becomes a godly king in the end of his life. And people would have probably thought that was just too impossible. It was too difficult. Not even God could do that because Manasseh is so evil. You may be facing a situation this morning where maybe you've been praying for your spouse for years and it just seems like they're just getting worse rather than better and they're so far away from God. Maybe you've got children and they're way away and they've gotten into trouble and you think, well, this is just so difficult. There's no hope. I want to say this morning that the story is not finished yet. The book is not finished yet. I love reading books, although I prefer to read them on Kindle now because it's a lot less cluttered. But there's something to be said about real books because it's like you're 3/4 of the way through and you're reading a real sad story, but you know that there's like 1/4 of the book left. And if it's a good book, it's gonna be a happy ending. But the story is not finished yet. What we do with our lives is we go through a struggle or a tragedy and we judge the whole story based on where we are on the journey, which is usually not the end. And then we say, well, this is over, this is tragic, there's no hope. And you're only like halfway through the book of your life. The story is not finished yet, and God is always the God of hope. So if God can turn a nation of evil pagan Satanists around, if he can turn an evil king who was one of the most evil kings in all of the land at that time, he can turn your situation around. Do you believe that this morning? Let's have a little bit of hope and dare to hope, because God is always the God of hope. Verse 10, when God saw what they had done and how they had put a stop to their evil ways, he changed his mind and did not carry out the destruction he had threatened. This is probably the biggest, most powerful revival in history. I did a bit of research on it yesterday. And probably the biggest one other than this was the Welsh revival in 1904, where over the course of 1 year, 100,000 people gave their lives to God and turned their lives around. And there's a lot of revivals, and if I'm wrong, please correct me later on, but that was over the course of a year, probably the most successful, amazing. But we see here in Nineveh, thousands of years ago, 120,000 people turned to God in a matter of days. This was probably the most significant revival in all of history. Jonah should have been rejoicing because God had chosen him to be the catalyst. This is like a dream come true for anyone. Living in something like this and witnessing it and being one of the primary characters in something that God had done like this, it would be absolutely phenomenal to be a part of that. And yet we see Jonah does not want to be a part of it. Instead of celebrating with them, he just doesn't want to be there. He runs away again. Jonah should have been overwhelmed with joy. Instead, he was judgmental, unforgiving, unloving, religious, lacking compassion, probably very racist, bitter, and twisted, and hateful. In chapter 1 and 2, we see Jonah's visible rebellion. And rebellion just means resisting authority. So it doesn't even have to be like an active, aggressive thing. If you're just resisting, it's rebellion. So we see that in 1 and 2, it's visible. Everyone can see it. He even tells the sailors, I'm running away from God. But in chapters 3 and 4, Jonah's still rebellious. It's just internal now. It's just a matter of the heart, not so much as outward behavior. And this is, I guess, again, another parallel to our journey with God. We struggle with outward things, and everyone knows that we're having a shocker, and we surrender, we give our lives to Christ, and then it probably takes the rest of our lifetimes to be sanctified with the attitudes and the things that no one else can see. But the attitudes are in there still, so maybe we're not outwardly, visibly rebellious, but maybe it's an internal thing now, like Jonah. So that's chapter 3, on to chapter 4, the last chapter. This change of plans greatly upset Jonah, and he became very angry. So he complained to the Lord about it. Didn't I say before I left home that you would do this, Lord? That is why I ran away to Tarshish. Here we go. I knew that you are a merciful and compassionate God, slow to get angry and filled with unfailing love. You are eager to turn back from destroying people. Just kill me now. Lord, I'd rather be dead than alive if what I predicted will not happen. It's just such a, it's so sad and tragic that it almost becomes humorous. So at the beginning of the story, I gave sort of four motivations as to why Jonah ran away. Maybe he was just scared. It would have been a fearful thing to go to a nation that is your enemies and declare that God's going to judge him. So it was a fearful thing. Maybe that was a motivation. We no longer know that that's the case. Maybe it was like a ministry burnout. He was exhausted, and maybe that's a part of it. I don't know. But we see here it's actually not one of the factors. The two other motivations were very true. He feared that his reputation would be ruined, and we see this now. He wants to be killed now because what he said is not going to come true. People may label him as the false prophet. So it's all about him and self, but mostly he knew that God would forgive the Ninevites. He knew that God was merciful, and he didn't think that was right. Remember that the Ninevites were evil. They chopped people's hands and feet off for fun. And Jonah may have had family, we don't know, that had been directly affected by the Ninevites. And maybe he knew of stories of how clans of Ninevites had come and raided families and raped and pillaged. And he he was struggling with forgiveness and the justice of it. Maybe he had every right to be upset because he had so much offense towards the Ninevites. He just wanted them to be judged, but he knew the heart of God, and he knew this all along, that God was compassionate and forgiving. Just like God was compassionate and forgiving when Jonah was going to drown, but he sent along a fish or a seal. God is forgiving, and he loves the lost, and he even loves the wicked. And sometimes we just struggle when there's not really any justice, but we just need to give that to God. God forgave the Ninevites. God forgave me. God forgave you. Because God is slow to anger. I love that about God. But Jonah was just, he just couldn't get his head around that. He was offended at God. Verse 4, the Lord replied, "Is it right for you to be angry about this?" And Jonah didn't answer. I think he knew the answer. But this time now, he chooses to remain silent. He's not going to take responsibility for his behavior and his actions anymore like he did a couple of chapters ago when he said, "This is my fault, I'm wrong." Now, when he's challenged with God and God touching some areas, heart areas, he's no longer willing to agree with God anymore. He just stays silent. But he knows the truth, he just doesn't want to admit it. Verse 5, then Jonah went to the east side of the city and made a shelter to sit under as he waited to see what would happen to the city. Maybe he just thought against hope, now I just want to see that God's going to do this. Maybe things are going to change. But He wasn't in, he didn't even partake in the celebrations, what God was doing. He chooses to run away from the purposes of God a second time. Perhaps not so dramatic anymore, perhaps not so far, but he still runs away. He's out of the purpose of God in his life again. There had just been a citywide revival. 120,000 people that didn't know anything about God had just turned to God. Who was the one person that they had a connection with that knew something about God? It was Jonah. If Jonah was a man at all, he would have thought, this is incredible. These guys need shepherding. These guys need some help because they don't know really anything. They're sitting in ashes and they're repenting, and that's good. But there's so much more to God. He could have been one of the greatest national leaders there, or even definitely in the king's court like a Daniel. We could have seen in history Nineveh becoming a godly city and a godly nation. But we don't see that at all. Actually, a few decades later, Nineveh gets destroyed by the Medes and the Chaldeans. I assume that they turned back to their wicked ways. One man, yes, did say yes to God and gives the message at first, but he was not willing to stay there because he just wanted to be comfortable, and he was still so obsessed with self and offense that he actually missed it. What's the point in speaking a message and seeing a nation turn when soon after it they're just going to turn away because of lack of leadership? So we see that Jonah was willing to obey God partially, but not wholeheartedly, which is a huge lesson here, and it's a very, very sad lesson. Because of personal offense, Jonah is not partaking in the celebrations. He's isolating himself. He's offended. And that's what will happen to an offended heart when God is doing something incredible, because we have taken hold of offense and we've become bitter. We just can't enter into the celebrations. We choose to isolate ourselves or to step aside and to point the finger and to judge. Offense is incredibly, it's dangerous to the life of a Christian. And the Lord God arranged, verse 6, for a leafy plant to grow there, and soon it spread its broad leaves over Jonah's head, shading him from the sun. This eased his discomfort, and Jonah was very grateful for the plant. But God also arranged for a worm. So he arranges for a whale, and now he arranges for a worm. I'd love to know what this worm looked like. We're talking about a pretty big tree here that can grow up pretty quick. This would have been one gnarly-looking worm, man. This is. The next morning at dawn, the worm ate through the stem of the plant so that it withered away. And as the sun grew hot, God arranged for a scorching east wind to blow on Jonah. The sun beat down on his head until he grew faint and wished to die. Death is certainly better than living like this, he exclaimed. Why is this happening? I've got a bit of a theory. Because God didn't want him to be away from the city. God still wanted Jonah to be in the city. Why? Because there is shade in the city. There are buildings in the city. There are celebrations in the city. And here he is outside the city on a hot desert cliff probably. Why didn't he just think, man, they've got shade, I'm just going to go back to town? He was so self-centered and obsessed with his comfort and how life was affecting him that, again, he lost complete view of the whole picture of 120,000 people that were now turning to God. It was all about Jonah's situation and his comfort and his ease and his rest, and he just completely lost sight of the big picture. And I think we can fall into this trap so often. Well, I can fall into this trap so often. Because life is difficult and life is challenging. Even when you're right in the middle of God's plans and purposes for your life, there are still going to be challenges. And I think I got a bit of a gentle rebuke from the Lord recently, because I can moan a little bit to God at times, and probably moan to other people as well. Oh, this is so challenging. This is so difficult. I really believe God spoke to my heart and said, Simon, a soldier does not go to war and think that it's going to be a holiday. Every soldier that enlists knows that it is not going to be easy. He knows that it's going to involve a lot of hardship, a lot of labor, probably a lot of pain. It's going to be a life-changing experience, and it may even cost that soldier his life. He goes there because he enlists because he wants to make a difference. But he realizes it's not going to be easy, it's going to be difficult. But he's got the opportunity to play a part in a much bigger thing of seeing the enemies and evil thwarted, and that's the big picture. And sometimes I think, for me anyway, and I'm preaching so much to myself this morning, it's not funny. Got to realize that the call of God is not going to be easy. There is going to be hardship. It is going to be challenging. But what did we really expect? Because we are playing a part in this huge, global, universal thing. And God's got an enemy, and his name is Satan. And Satan hates you, and Satan hates me, and Satan hates people, and Satan hates the world, and Satan wants everyone to go to hell. But God loved the world so much, he sent his son to die on the cross for you and me so that we could have hope and we could have eternal life. But it's not just for us. It's for this world that still is lost and wicked and doesn't know God. And God has chosen me, and God has chosen you to play a part in that. What a privilege. It's not going to be easy sometimes. As they say in every war movie I've probably ever seen, suck it up. Simon, suck it up. Hoorah. You know, I love watching war movies. I'd never want to fight a war. It's like, man, that's just tough. But God has called us. As soon as we get saved, we're in the battle. We're in the army, whether we like it or not. Anyway. The Lord said, you feel sorry about a plant, although you did nothing to put it there. It came quickly and died quickly. But Nineveh has more than 120,000 people living in spiritual darkness, not to mention all the animals. I find that line incredible because God cares for animals as well there. Shouldn't I feel sorry for such a great city? And then it ends. What a ridiculous place to end a story. I really get frustrated when you're watching a movie and the ending's ambiguous. It's like Inception, you know, the movie, one of my favorite movies. And at the end, like, the guy's spinning his little, for those of you that don't, I don't know, it probably won't make any sense, but he's spinning this spinning top, which he did in his dreams. And if it would keep on going, then he would know that it isn't his dreams. But if it stopped, then he realized that he's actually not dreaming. He's awake. And it's like a happy ending with his kids and everything's, he's reconciled. And he spins his spinning top because he wants to know if it's a dream or if it's real. And we don't know. That's just the end of the movie. It's like, what happened to the spinning top? Is this real or is it? And then you go on, if you're anything like me, you go on forums and spend like hours reading movie theories as to what. It's just like, what? Why did they do that? And I'll tell you why, because the message is left with us. We are left thinking, what? Why? What is going to happen next? What is the outcome? And it haunts us because we realize that, what is the ending? And I think that's the reason why Jonah finishes like this. It just like stops. The greatest lesson of the book of Jonah is not that a man survived 3 days and 3 nights in the belly of a fish. It is rather that God is concerned that all human beings be reconciled to him. I think that is the message of the book of Jonah. It's not about that a man survived 3 days, 3 nights in the belly of a fish. It's rather that God is concerned that all human beings be reconciled to him. 2 Peter 3 in the first and in the New Testament. The Lord isn't really being slow about his promise, as some people think. No, he's being patient for your sake. He does not want anyone to be destroyed, but wants everyone to repent. Jonah runs, God chases, Jonah surrenders, God is gracious, the city is waiting, the second chance, the city repents, and Jonah runs. It's incredible, actually. I heard Don Barry speak about it once, that there is an incredible parallel between the book of Jonah and the parable of the lost son in the New Testament. I've always thought it shouldn't really be the parable of the lost son. It should be called the parable of the lost sons, because there were two sons. One son was in direct rebellion and ran away from his father. and he comes to his senses and he returns to his father. But there is also a rebellious son, the son of the house. He doesn't outwardly run away, but he's got a heart of rebellion. He doesn't want to accept the son's return. He's got a lot of things that aren't right in his life. And I think the first two chapters of Jonah, exemplify the first son. In Jonah's life, the first two chapters, he's very much like that first son where he runs away and it's very visible. But I think chapters 3 and 4 of Jonah, he's very much like the second son, the older son, who's in the house but has got a lot of internal issues, still rebellious, still far away from God. We may not be the first son this morning that is an outright rebellion and our lives are a mess, but it's quite possible that perhaps there are aspects of the second son in our lives where we are children of the house and we're doing most things right. People would never see the attitudes of our heart, but God sees. And I think that's quite amazing when you look at Jonah's life. We don't know how Jonah responds. It's interesting, though, when he was in the storm, he takes responsibility. He says, "This is my fault." A little bit later on, when God asks him a question, he doesn't answer. But we see at the end of Jonah, he says in verse 9, I didn't even cover verse 9. Let's go back to verse 9. Then God said to Jonah, "Is it right for you to be angry because the plant died?" "Yes," Jonah retorted, "even angry enough to die." So Jonah takes responsibility when there's a storm. The second time God asks him a direct question, he chooses not to say anything. The third time God asks him a direct question, instead of saying, "I take responsibility, I am wrong," Jonah then starts to be aggressive and defending his rebellion. Even though he's a servant of God and he's done incredible things, his heart is still running from God. Jonah runs, God chases, Jonah surrenders, God is gracious, the city is waiting, the second chance, the city repents, Jonah runs. It finishes with verse 10 and 11, "Then the Lord said, 'You feel sorry about the plant, though you did nothing to put it there. It came quickly and died quickly, but Nineveh has more than 120,000 people living in spiritual darkness, not to mention all the animals. Shouldn't I feel sorry for such a great city?'" And then it stops. Thomas Carlyle, the poet, says, "And Jonah stalked to his shaded seat and waited for God to come around to his way of thinking. And God is still waiting for a host of Jonahs in their comfortable houses to come around to his way of thinking, his way of loving." I'll say it again. "And Jonah stalked to his shaded seat and waited for God to come around to his way of thinking. And God is still waiting for a host of Jonahs in their comfortable houses to come around to his way of loving."
Thanks so much for listening. We hope it was an encouragement to you. To contact us or to find out what's happening at our church, please check out our website, renewchurch.nz.